Welcome to Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's show is my dear friend, John Bonner. Welcome, John.
Thank you, my friend.
John has become somewhat famous on social media as he has shared his journey as a gay Mormon man. I became aware of John a few years ago as I became an LGBTQ ally while serving as a YSA bishop, and felt impressed to learn the stories of God's LGBTQ children. I think I've read everything John's written, as I've been trying to follow what Sister Fiona Givens teaches. Quote, every Latter-day Saint who wishes to bear one another's burden must first touch the person's cross to understand the nature and depth of the pain being carried. It is only then that the other person can truly mourn with the one who mourns, part of our baptism covenants. On February 15th of this year, 2018, John's story kind of exploded in Mormon circles and beyond as church-owned LDS Living ran a story titled, You Are My People. An active gay Mormon shares powerful insights after attending church for the first time in years. In today's podcast, we'll hear John's journey as a gay man, his experience attending church on January 28th, which led to the LDS Living article. So glad to have you here, John.
Thank you. I'm not famous. But by the way, that was my first correction. I'm decidedly not famous. You're way more famous than I am, but thank you for the shout out.
Well, and it is good to have John here. John has helped me so much as I felt impressed to learn how God feels about his LGBTQ children by not talking to straight people, by talking to LGBTQ people. And reading John's posts has been so helpful for me, and then the chance to meet John and visit with him. But John, this is about you. I want to have you do most of the talking. Give us some background on you, where you grew up, and some of your interests growing up, and also where you became aware of your sexual orientation and how you dealt with that.
Okay. I was telling them beforehand, I'm going to try and diversify because I've answered some of these questions before. So I grew up in Rexburg, Idaho, the goodly land of Mormondom, which is way more Mormon than lots of parts of Utah, which people within Mormondom know. So yeah, that was all I knew growing up, really, was the LDS experience. I knew very few people who weren't LDS, and the people I knew who weren't were still defined in relation to that of being active, less active, which was interesting with the LDS Living article to be classified as inactive. I haven't thought of myself that way for a long time. That's not what I titled the piece. I titled it Claiming Each Other, and they had to give it some clickable hook by retitling it the way they did. And they consulted me about that. I said that was fine. It made sense to me. But that brought me back to thinking of everybody in terms of their relationship to the church. Somebody said that to me a few years ago, that everybody in Utah is Mormon. They're ex-Mormon, former Mormon, non-Mormon, active Mormon, believing Mormon, but that's the world that I grew up in Rexburg, Idaho. So, and I was one of the active believing people. It was my whole world. It was my native tongue and my heart and everything that I knew. I have two loving parents and two older sisters. My elder sisters have both since parted ways with the church as well, but we grew up in a home where we knew we were loved, and that has been a really important part of my journey as well, of coming to accept myself and have room for that. That said, that has been a challenge in some ways too. That's been a growing process. I want to put that caveat in because I think people can hear me tell this story and look at my parents now and me posting very publicly and often about my mom, who's my best friend and whom I dearly love, and my dad, who has come around in remarkable ways as well. But that was not always the case. They did not always know how to make room for this unique, different, flamboyant kid. Mm-hmm. And when I first came out to them, that was a challenge for both of them. They weren't both immediately accepting, but that over the course of 10 years they did. So that fast forwards me my journey, but I just wanted to
How
to
old
say
were
that.
You when you came out, John, and what caused you to come out?
That's a good question. So you had asked me before, like when I knew I was gay, and I knew from the time that I was five. I wouldn't have labeled it in terms of sexuality. Obviously, like I didn't know what that was, but I knew that I had crushes on other boys, and that when we played kissing tag in kindergarten, like I wanted to kiss the other boys, and that's the first moment I really knew that that was probably true of me, and also that that was something that other people didn't want me to be, because my kindergarten teacher held me outside of the classroom on our way back in from recess and scolded me for chasing the other boys, and told me in no uncertain terms not to do that. And so I felt a deep wash of shame around that, and knew that that was something that I should keep hidden, but knew that that the same like kind of tingling excitement that other people felt, my peers felt toward girls, was something that I felt toward boys, and like thinking they were cute, wanting to hold their hand, being interested in them kind of way. So that was something that lived inside of me for a long time. I admitted it to myself for the first time when I was 14, and vowed that I would never tell anybody, which I didn't until I was 25. And so,
wow.
Yeah. So a long gap where I didn't tell anybody. People thought that, of course, and some people asked me directly. A couple of my best friends in high school, a girl that I was dating, like they asked me in a kind, open way, like they would have been accepting, like they're huge allies now, and they were progressive even then, especially for Rexburg. But I was offended by the question and told them that, of course, that I wasn't. And I think they probably knew better, but they took me at my word, because I was afraid to acknowledge that to myself, because to me, being gay meant that you were going to be separate from the light of Christ and everything good and wholesome that I knew. And it was something foreign and unfamiliar to me growing up in a very small town at that time in the 90s. And had grown up through the height of the AIDS epidemic, so I had a very pejorative view of what it meant to be gay and the potential fatality of being gay.
Go back to a term you said that's okay. Wash of shame. Hmm. That's a very thoughtful term. Just explain to our listeners more about that phrase and what that means to you. Hmm. And especially others that might feel shame and what you'd want to say to them.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, it felt like a very visceral experience whenever I would feel shame. I mean, it's inextricably tied to my sexuality, actually, because every time I had a sexual thought or a sexual fantasy, like that feeling of like entirely, you guys can't see me, but I'm moving my hands in front of my face over my body, like this entire enveloping feeling of shame would immediately follow any desire, any longing that I experienced in relation to my sexuality, which has taken a long time to undo. I'm still probably undoing that, if I'm honest. When you're natural, for I think all of us really is an inborn natural desire, love, interest in people becomes paired with a sense of you being broken or flawed, that it takes a lot of work to get comfortable, to undo your internalized homophobia, to come to accept yourself and the legitimacy and the beauty of those feelings when you grow up in a world, and especially, like I said, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, when I grew up, of that almost universally told you that that was not acceptable. It wasn't just in my community. It wasn't just because I grew up in Rexburg, Idaho, or that I was, that I was in a small town or predominantly Mormon town. Like, that was the whole landscape at the time everywhere. People weren't out in high school. Gay marriage wasn't legal anywhere in the world at that time. So it felt like the natural response to these feelings was shame, because I didn't know anybody who was owning that. I didn't see that celebrated anywhere. I mean, Ellen DeGeneres came out publicly on her show when I was in high school, and I was so excited for that episode, and I watched it by myself, and I cried when I watched it, and And then I was so heartbroken to see the response afterwards, to see the interview on Oprah and to see her on the Time magazine cover. And like, there was this moment of celebration, but like then the response from the studio audience on Oprah and the questions, and then like the immediate backlash from lots of conservatives and her losing her show and having it be canceled after being the top rated comedy, and losing her career for several years. Same happened to Rosie O'Donnell. So like the things that we think of now as like the examples of like, there's these websites after Ellen and after Elton, like my era of knowing Elton John and Ellen DeGeneres was that they had to go back into the closet in some sense, or that they had huge repercussions career-wise, that there wasn't the way that we think of it now of that being a platform to speak your truth, live your truth, and then have success. That wasn't modeled to me in any way. So shame was like the only thing that I really knew associated with that. That's the way everybody that I knew talked about being gay.
Thanks. Shame is certainly a word that when I was a YSA bishop at first, I didn't really understand the word shame. Mm. And after serving for a while and then talking to clinical people, that was a word that I understood a lot better. Mm. And just realize that that's not a word I think God wants anybody to feel. And you would be more of an expert on this than I would, John, but I would think God would want all of his LGBTQ people to not feel any shame about their orientation, that that's a beautiful gift from God, and everybody's orientation should be viewed as wonderful and whole and not broken. But I recognize where our society for gay and lesbian trans people cause people to feel immense shame. Do you feel, any thoughts on just that thought?
Yeah, I didn't answer the second part of your question of what the definitional part of it, as well as what I would say to people who are struggling with shame. So I think a simple definition that's helpful to me is that guilt is about what you have done, which can also not always be productive, but shame is about who you are and can be much more destructive because it feels like that can't be changed, that it's irreparable, that it's irredeemable. And I think people can get, regardless of sexuality or gender identity, people can be plagued with shame for all kinds of reasons. And I do think some of that's reinforced by a church where I think people are sincerely wanting to strive to do their best, but the sense of perfectionism, be therefore perfect, even as our Father in heaven is, can really be a burden and a plague for people. And it can get tied in with who they are instead of what they've done. And that can feel insurmountable to people. And that can lead people to lose hope. And unfortunately lead people to take their life. And that's where I was for a long time. I mean, that's...
I love that definition, John. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Talk about, if you will, just your own feelings of suicide and just how you dealt with that. Because most people I've talked to have been on that road, and it's been, rightly so, a very brutal road. And that seems to be a logical thing to consider given the pain that one feels.
Yeah. That's what I was going to segue into. That I... That's part of why I decided not to talk to anybody about it for so long. Why I made that vow at 14 to never speak it aloud to another person, because that felt like it would make it real. It would give it too much power, that it was something that I could never be, but knew deep down that I was. And so living that duality caused deep shame, deep despair. I mean, I was like many gay people. I was really celebrated for outward things, right? Like I was a precocious kid. I was good with words, and I was in the gifted and talented program, and I started out early as a writer and a singer, and got lots of props for that, got lots of kudos and accolades for the things that I was performatively good at. And so I was celebrated in one hand, especially within the context of Mormonism, and then inside felt like I was nothing, felt that no one could ever love me, felt that I wasn't worth anything. So all of those accolades felt like a lie. Like instead of building me up, it felt like a heightened degree of this juxtaposition that I was holding, that if they really knew me. So the bigger it felt like to me, the charade was getting, or the facade that I was putting forward for people, the deeper the despair that this thing in me couldn't change. Because I thought, well, I should be this thing that people are loving, that they're applauding, that they're celebrating. Why can't I be? And why is this other thing growing up in me that needs to be rooted out and destroyed? So that eventually led me to thinking that, well, I must need to destroy myself then, because I can't be fixed.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I love the way you set up that. That's very helpful for me and hopefully our listeners, is just how you were excelling in so many different areas with your God-given talents, but the dissonance that created within you and the concern that if people knew the quote, the real you, that they wouldn't love you, mm-hmm. and the pain that that generated. That's very helpful and very thoughtful. How did you keep telling us about your journey, John? You're doing a great job.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate the chance to talk. It's nice. I'm a therapist, so I'm usually the one doing the listening, so it's nice to have such sincere questions. Thank you. I think that was the point that led me to needing to come out, because it reached a really acute point when I was 25. I had become the gold star gay, which many of us are. That's why the term exists. Like, I was graduated with honors, was full scholarship, went on a mission, assistant to the president on my mission, ticked all the boxes. Alaska, which I loved, which I still have very fond memories of in many ways. And I was really close to the missionaries, and by all traditional measures had a very successful mission, but a painful mission as well, because I was hated by a few of the missionaries who sensed or perceived that I was gay, and were cruel to me as a result. The vast majority were not, and I was well beloved in lots of ways on my mission. I feel fortunate about that, but that again was this contrast, right, of that some of those same companions or missionaries who saw that other people really celebrated me because of my capacity to love people, because my capacity to talk to people, because my success as a missionary and the ways that that's measured, really resented and hated me because of that, because they thought that they could see this other part of me that made me unworthy, that should make it so I shouldn't be on a mission, that even though I'd never acted on it, even though I'd never engaged in that in any way, because of the way I acted, because of the way I talked, because of my mannerisms, that they despised me, and more so because of the love that they saw me generating among church members and investigators and other missionaries. So that was a painful part of my mission, but for the most part, I came to love lots of things about Alaska and my time there. But so I had done all these things, and I was at BYU and 4.0, and had started singing in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and I was doing all the things.
Tell us how you got involved. That's really cool. Tell us how you got involved with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Thanks. Yeah.
Deal, John.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I've had a very fortunate choral career. I've been really blessed that way. Yeah, I sang in Collegiate Singers at BYU Idaho for a couple of years, and I was in my Madrigals group, a cappella group in high school, Bel Cantos. Shout out to the Bel Cantos, at Madison High School in Rexburg growing up. And then when I went to BYU, I was in BYU Singers with Ron Staley for all 6 years that I was there, and I dearly love him. And that experience saved me in lots of real ways. Like, music has always been a balm and a saving grace for me in my life. So that has not felt like an option. Like I said to you before we were starting the podcast, like, that has felt like a necessity to me. It felt that way then too. And so I love singing in smaller ensembles, and that really filled me. But I was watching the 2002 Winter Olympics and saw this, you know, global platform that the Motab had in their beautiful white coats, and the whole world's hearing them sing, and I thought, I want to do that. So I auditioned right after that, that spring, and I wasn't old enough yet. I was 24. They had just lowered the age to 25, but because of my choral background, because I knew Mac and had met Craig, they let me audition, and they accepted me in. So for the first year and a half, I was the youngest member of Motab.
That's cool.
Yeah, so that was so. And because Rexburg's such a small town, I was on the front page of the Rexburg Standard Journal. It's cool and also sad. But that's the most newsworthy thing happening in the town. But again, that was something that I didn't know how to feel proud of. I felt ashamed of, because I was on the cover, like, big color, full color photo of me on the cover of Rexburg Standard Journal. I pulled out all the stops doing the full color photo and the big write-up. And I knew that I was not the celebrated hometown hero that they wanted me to be. I knew that I had this other thing living inside of me. So I had graduated from BYU, and I was that summer. I was preparing to do graduate work in clinical social work, but I had a gap year. I had to do some prerequisites, and I went to Mexico. I served in an orphanage in Mexico for a semester, which I loved, and
what part of
learned
Mexico?
Spanish, Guadalajara. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful experience, and I had an affinity for the language, and I loved the host family that I lived with, and I loved those kids so much. But that also put me in a real contact with the longing that I had to be a parent, to be a father, and the reality that maybe that wasn't going to happen. And I was lucky to be really loved by these kids who had been traumatized and abandoned, literally orphaned, who allowed me into their hearts in a really surprising and profound way, the way that they took to me, partly because I sang to them every day. I brought a guitar and I would sing, and they would sing with me. And I went home from that, and my roommates had just happened to be doing pest control and living scriptures, and so they were gone most of the time. They're great guys who I love dearly, still, I'm still connected to, but I had built up my life, right, to do all these things, and I checked off all the boxes, and I was as gay as ever, and came home from Mexico, came home to an empty apartment, and was more serious than I ever had been before about taking my life. And I'd been quite serious about it before. I'd had previous times of making plans and having close to attempts. But that got to a real crisis point where I realized if I didn't tell somebody, I would die, literally. And so I made an appointment with an intake counselor at the BYU Counseling Center, and I told the female therapist, I don't remember her name, but it took me a long time, lots of silence, to get out the words that I couldn't say gay, but that I was attracted to men. And I imagine she might have surmised that before I said it, but I expected the walls to crumble down around in that room and BYU to sink into the earth for me saying that thing. That's how deep my shame was. But she listened patiently, and she nodded, and she was kind, and she connected with me with a couple different therapists that I had for 3 years there, who were at the time were reparative therapists, which was not something that I advocate, but they were good men who also wanted to help me, and who I'm still connected to as a therapist, that I've reconnected with them as a non-client adult colleague, and they have both progressed in their own journey of their understanding of homosexuality. They no longer practice reparative therapy. They have both continued to work with an LDS LGBTQ population, but in a beautiful, affirmative, healing way, like a reparation for their years of reparative therapy, maybe. So I it was still helpful for me to meet with somebody who could help me deprogram some of the shame, while also, I'll say honestly, reinforcing some of the other shame. But I at least had somebody who was witnessing my pain, and who I owe my life to in some ways. Like I wrote a piece about this, but I had, at that point, by the time I was onto my second counselor, I had bought a box cutter at the BYU bookstore, and I was carrying it around in my backpack for some weeks. And I had come in to say goodbye to him, and he could tell that something was off, and he'd asked me if I was making plans to end my life, and I told him I was. And he asked if I had means, and I reluctantly told him about the box cutter that I had bought, the razor in my backpack, and I took it out, and he insisted that I give it to him if I would be willing, and I reluctantly did, and he wanted me to create a list of people who would miss me if I weren't here, and he looked me in the eyes. His name's Mike Buxton. He deserves a shout out. He's a good man. And said, I want you to add my name to the list. And that was a really profound, powerful moment for me of knowing that this person who was choked up as he said it, like, he really showed his humanity of deeply caring about me as a person, and not just as a client he was seeing. And that was powerful for me. And I, through the process of that therapy and realizing that it wasn't working, it wasn't making me straight, but I also was allowed to explore for the first time some parts of me that I hadn't been able to before, and started going to some support groups, Evergreen at the time, which, again, I don't espouse that ideology necessarily, but it put me in contact with other gay men, and I could see for the first time something that I couldn't undo fully for myself, like that they were beautiful and that they were powerful. powerful and talented and that they didn't need to change. And I saw too many of them succeed in taking their lives. And I felt the tragedy of that, and I came to love them. And I realized that that's maybe, just maybe, if I could see them that way, and God probably saw them that way, that maybe God could see me that way too. And that was the beginning of me really starting to change the way I saw myself.
I love hearing more of this story, John. I've picked up some of it. That story of writing a list of all the people and for that counselor to add his name to the list. And that's a pretty touching story. And I think it's good for all of our listeners to just reflect on that, those that are trying to help people and those of our listeners that are filled with darkness. Mm-hmm. So thank you for sharing that. Your story helped me, and it's helping our listeners tonight. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Tell us more about your story. Do you want to talk more about the choir? Do you want to talk more about coming to terms and just at peace with your sexuality?
Yeah, I think that could be a good segue, maybe into partly helping us advance to where I am now. Because I think that people will ask me, because I still obviously write and talk about Mormonism frequently. People probably get tired of me talking about it. But I'm grateful that people are still willing to listen.
Keep talking, John. There's lots of newbies like me that need to hear all this stuff.
Thanks. I don't want to be indulgent. I feel like I've told my story lots of times, so I'm grateful that people still want to listen. But people will wonder why I still am deeply connected to Mormonism, because I haven't been actively participating in the church for just over a decade. But it's still in me, and so when people ask me, like, how was your mission, or how was your experience?
And you're 40. Tell us how old
you are
right
now. I'm 40. I just turned 40.
You're young, John.
I don't feel young sometimes. But, when people ask me how BYU was, how my mission was, how singing the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was, I give a nuanced answer, but I can tell them honestly that I loved those things, just like I told you. I mean, people often ask in an apologetic way, like, oh, you went to BYU, I'm so sorry, how did you escape? And I tell them that, you know, there were aspects of it that were genuinely hard. There were aspects of it that shouldn't have been true. I had traumatizing experiences there as well, but there are also things that I deeply loved about it. Rexburg and Alaska and Provo and Salt Lake are where I've met some of the dearest people in my life and had some of my most cherished musical experiences, spiritual experiences, literary experiences, human-to-human experiences. And I wouldn't trade that. Like, I don't know how to undo the whole first part of my life, and I don't wish to do that. Like, so a lot of my work now is trying to reclaim that, so I hope it's not whitewashing that. Like, sometimes get accused of being overly sympathetic or fond toward the church or toward my background, but I feel like I want to make sense of that in a way that honors who I was and shows compassion to that. So, yeah, there were things that
I think that's very, very thoughtful.
Thank you.
I mean, sometimes it's easier just to sort of be black and white, and I think it's harder to do what you're doing, is recognize the good and the stuff that's not good, or the stuff that's very painful, and sort of be willing to be aware of the pain and sort of be aware of the good. I think I admire you for trying to do that.
Thank you. And I'll give an example of that in a, I hope, succinct way. In direct relation to your question. So there were times singing in the Tabernacle Choir and in BYU Singers that I was as happy as I've ever been, that I just, like, my whole being felt full, like it was going to burst with light and joy. And I didn't choose to leave either organization. Like, I had told my bishop at the time at BYU that I had kissed a boy, and that's literally all it was, nothing beyond that. And I don't even know that that is something that one needs to confess, but because of all the layers of shame I had around it, I did. And he responded in a pretty panicked way. He was the chief of police in Provo at the time and had a very pejorative, criminalized view of sexuality, of people kind of cruising in bathroom stalls and perpetrating on others, etc. So he had a very, very negative view of it. And when I told him that, he said he wouldn't renew my ecclesiastical endorsement because you're set apart as a missionary when you're in the Tabernacle Choir. And I obviously needed an ecclesiastical endorsement to continue at BYU and to sing in BYU Singers. And so that conversation, telling him that I had kissed another boy, which I was at the time 27, And that was the first person I'd ever kissed. Clothes on, chased by any standard, and lost my ecclesiastical endorsement because of that, and had to leave the Tabernacle Choir and BYU Singers and BYU.
Wow.
So that's part of the pain of that. That's part of the story.
John, I'm just so sorry. That's really painful.
I'm sorry and not sorry, and I'm not meaning to cut you off. I'm just wanting to say, like, some part of me, and I don't, maybe this is being ameliorative of a really painful experience, but I regret how that happened. I don't think that should have ever happened with that bishop and with the director of LDS Family Services that I was interviewing with as a clinical social worker, who told me I would never work for their agency. Like, that, those things were abusive and harmful, and they should not have happened. I also needed to see, or have an experience that allowed me to come face to face with some of the harmful parts of what I was involved in and what I had adhered myself to, because I needed to be able to, I think, to save myself, to take some step away from that as well. And I don't see that as the totality of the church. Obviously, I'm sitting here with you. I love you dearly. I think you're as good a man as I know.
Thank you for having that thoughtful,
sincerely,
kind of non-black and white response.
Yeah, no, I love you. You are Christ's love embodied. I mean that. I don't say that lightly. So I know that exists in Mormon people. My mom's my favorite human being on planet Earth, and she is as Mormon as they come, and she is as good a human as you will find. And there are also parts of the organizational or institutional church that can be very harmful to an LGBTQ person if they stay, and especially at that time. I mean, we're talking about the late 90s and early to mid 2000s, which was a different era. And I needed to come face to face with some of the ways that I was not welcomed or accepted, so that I could start crafting a way to be welcomed and accepted for myself.
That's a big pivot in my mind. Just that experience with the church, talking to your bishop, then having all those are very dramatic dominoes to fall.
Right.
I mean, those are big key parts of your life that just significantly changed because of that one interaction with the local bishop. And
right, and the like I said, the local or the regional director of LDS Family Services,
yes,
at the time, and that also happened. I mean, it coincided also with, I mean, this was December of 2006, and so /  January 2007. So this was also right before the church publicly got involved in Prop 8, and so that happened that next summer, where the letter was read from church leadership asking people to donate their time, means, whatever resources they could to supporting Proposition 8. To enshrine marriage as being only between a man and a woman, and deny that same right to same-sex couples in California. So there was, yes, indeed, a domino effect, but there was lots of things happening at the same time that made it pretty clear that somebody like me wasn't as welcomed there as my heterosexual peers.
And is that when if you say you haven't been going to church for a decade or so, is that kind of when it all happened?
Yeah.
Was it kind of a gradual thing where you felt the need to step away?
No, I kept going through that semester. I tried to go to the family ward, but that same bishop said that he would transfer my records wherever I went, and there was no way I was going to be returning to the Lord's school. And so that was hard. And I was going to the family ward anyway, and knew that I transferred to the U, which they were gracious about easing that, coalescing that process to make it, to mitigate how painful it could have been, it already was, to allow me to transfer that fall, which I was grateful for. But I was still attending through that summer the family ward where I lived, instead of the young single adult ward that he was the bishop of. And that they read that letter over the pulpit in that ward about supporting any amendments, referendums, any like that were happening around the world and addressing the sanctity of the traditional nuclear family, and rejecting other, what they would call, counterfeit forms of family organizations. And at the time, that wasn't as public. I mean, they had started doing that. They did that before with Proposition 22 in California, which I knew about, and they were actually doing it actively when I was on my mission in Alaska. There was a referendum in the Alaska state government around that same issue. So I had been aware of that, but it hadn't had the same momentum, the same national and international exposure that the church's involvement in Proposition 8 had had. But of course, that had been percolating in me, coinciding with my own coming to love and accept myself and deprogram some of the shaming messages with the church's more public, active, at the forefront involvement with these initiatives, referendums, propositions related to gay marriage. And so that was the last time I went to church on my own accord. I went one time after that in the ward that I moved to in Salt Lake. And it was a good experience, but I had at that time also started to study some of the historicity issues with the church. And the lesson was on Joseph Smith, and the westward migration, and there was no mention of polygamy. And that did not coincide with some of the other things I had been learning. And so it wasn't because I was offended. It was because my whole life has become about trying to tell the truth, about things that are difficult to tell. And I wanted that. I craved that in the church. And I think that's starting to happen, which is why I wrote the recent piece that I did. I think people are feeling the same way. I think there have always been pioneers in the church who are willing to do that. People who are forward-thinking, people who are willing to rock the boat or be agitators, maybe would have been called heretics, but people who are saying like, hey, we need to draw a big circle, have a big tent, circle our wagons around the most vulnerable, as I said in my piece. And I think that is true. I think that's starting to happen more so. I think that you're a beautiful example of that. But at that particular time, I think people felt kind of hunkered down. There was a kind of a false dichotomy created of an us versus them. And it felt like I was arbitrarily put on this dividing line of the church versus the gays, which was deeply painful because I felt like I was both. And yeah. So it felt like splitting me in half. And
it was painful. Did that lead to some of your, and you're doing a great job of sharing your story, did that lead to some of your darkest times, the back to the box cutter times, or were you okay even though it was an incredibly brutal time for you?
Yeah, good question. No, I mean, I had developed some resiliency, but no, that's an insightful and incisive question. It did create a resurgence of that, and which I've tried to speak to and write about as well, that there was as much as my departure from full participation in Mormonism at that time because of my sexuality was painful, it was equally as painful or more so to call into question the entirety of my faith and my belief system, not even within the parameters of Mormonism, but just is there a God? Is there an afterlife? Why are we here? You know, the fundamental questions that I had loved that Mormonism answered in this really beautiful, evocative, compelling way of where do we come from? Why are we here and where we're going? Suddenly all of those were up for question. I didn't know if I would see my mom again after she died. I didn't know what would happen to me. I didn't know if anybody was listening when I prayed, which I kept doing and still do. Even though I still probably would call myself a hopeful agnostic, but that was deeply painful to have the existential rug pulled out from under my feet and then to be spinning hopelessly in some dark, unfathomable space that I didn't know how to grapple with.
So it was a tough time, and it sounds like, if I'm understanding you correctly, that as you stepped away from Mormonism, like many people I meet with, it doesn't just stop at Mormonism, it's potentially your whole belief system and wondering if there's a God, which creates tremendous unsettledness.
Absolutely.
And as you said, you love your mom and you want to be with your mom and wondering how that all works if you're not sure how you feel about God or if there is a God.
Right.
And I think you said you're a hopeful agnostic right now.
I am.
Tell us what a hopeful agnostic is.
This is where you're going to lose your listeners, Richard. They've been with me till now and they're like, no, peace out. I'm done. Yeah, that means what I think we can best explain things definitionally sometimes by our stories. And so when I say that in practice, what that means for me, like I said, is that I pray all the time still, which probably to maybe a true agnostic, though that's an oxymoron, a convicted agnostic, wouldn't make much sense that I'm praying all the time still, but that's what I know to do. And the hopeful part is that I like to believe that somebody's listening, and oftentimes I feel like someone is. Because of growing up Mormon, like, of course, that became phrased as Heavenly Father, and envisioning what I had traditionally envisioned that to mean, a corporeal being to God. I don't know if that's what that looks like, but I believe that it's comforting to me. It's familiar to me to pray to God as a person, and in this case as a man, because that's what I, as a father, because that's what I grew up with. But I do believe that there are supernal forces in the universe that we don't always understand, that there's the numinous that we want to reach and touch, but can't always, and that's beyond our comprehension. And I think of that as God. I think of God as love. I think God is the connection we have with each other. I still feel that in my life, and that's maybe why the emphasis on the hopeful piece, which to some people may cancel out the agnostic piece, but I think both are equally important. And for me, agnosticism means that in the true sense, that I just don't know, that I feel like there's things that we can't prove, and that doesn't mean that I disbelieve them. That doesn't mean that I'm trying to refute them or disprove them. It just means that I feel like I would like an afterlife that includes me seeing my mother's face at the end of it.
Tell us your mother's name.
Her name is Sherry. Sherry Bonner. Shout out to my mom.
I've seen you over and over again post pictures with your mom and you.
Yeah, she's my best friend.
And I just love that relationship and the love that's there. And it's wonderful the way you honor her. And she loves you. And I can just see that reciprocal relationship.
Thank you. I'm lucky to have her. She spoils me. She's the... Yeah, my efforts pale in comparison to her. She came over today and surprised me with chicken pot pie for lunch. So that is my 78-year-old mom. She's the best. So yeah, I think that there's a part of me that just yearns to connect to something beyond my understanding, to connect to the love that I can feel as that I called all my life, the Spirit, the Holy Ghost. I still feel those promptings, those urges, those inexplainable, forward moving, burning in the soul feelings that lead me to do things that I can't rationally explain, but that often lead to important outcomes in my life.
I love your use of the word hope. Mm-hmm. And I love how to me, that's a positive word. It's forward thinking. I think it's one of the things that we're given here on earth, and maybe music helps you have hope. I love your honesty with your own faith. Mm-hmm. My feeling is to validate everybody's individual feelings about their own faith, and you've worked so hard on your own faith, John. Mm-hmm. My impression is where you're supposed to be with your faith, and my feelings is you're God's son and he loves you, and you've worked really hard on your lifelong relationship with God, doing wonderful things in your life, and he'll continue to be with you, and you'll continue to know what your path is and what your faith is. And I don't think you're on the wrong path right now, John. I don't think if God came right now, he would probably say, I think you ought to be here or here. My impression with most people I meet is they're kind of where God thought they'd be, and God's pretty happy with what they're doing. It would mostly just wrap their arms around people and tell them how much they love them and what a wonderful life they're living and all the people they're helping.
I want to briefly comment that it makes me emotional to hear you use that phrase to describe it, to call it my faith, because that's something that I felt like I lost, like the people I had been revered for the ways that people viewed my capacity to articulate my faith before, that they were expressive, feeling moved by that, of feeling inspired by that. And I know it sounds like arrogance or hubris maybe, but it was that felt like that was in my bones, and that was what I knew how to do, that was speaking my faith, was just talking, because that was me. And then I felt like I lost that. The people didn't see me as having a faith anymore once it became less rigidly defined, or like the parameters around that. Yeah, exactly. By church attendance and by like the orthodoxy of belief. And so like to hear you say in a very sincere way that you honor the way that I live my faith feels affirming, and also feels right to me, because I feel like it doesn't look the way it would to lots of traditional church members. They may not even call it that. They might balk at that. But I think it's what I'm trying to do. I think it's my version of that may look like doing a podcast with you or writing a piece and submitting it to LDS Living, and are continuing to go every week as I do to gather with lots of Mormons who I love, who are supremely talented to sing. that that's my way of worshiping still, or having brunch with my friends, or spending most Sundays with my parents. Like that's my way of worshiping and communing, and it feels like faith to me as much as anything else.
As you talk, it feels like Christ of the New Testament. And what he taught, and how he loved people, and how he gathered people around, and how everybody was worthy of his company, and he made it about companionship and about helping each other. And I love the example of his ministry, and I would also think that part of your faith is what you're doing with your career to help so many people. Mm-hmm. That's outside of a church administrative or a church ministerial assignment, but is it possible that your calling in life now is to minister to all the people through your clinical training that no one else can reach? And no one else, because of your unique road and your clinical training, can reach people and help people that no one else can. And no one knows about that, John. It's pretty private, the people that you help and the insights that you have. So, you know, on behalf of me and anybody listening, we thank you for what you're doing. And I realize I only know just a glimpse of that. I'm struck by the bishop conversation. I think you're pretty kind to that bishop and recognize that was not a helpful situation, but recognize that may have been a bishop that didn't know better. But I think it's a good learning experience for you to share that so that we can all do better. I remember not being perfect as a bishop, but I remember I wanted to let everybody know whatever they told me. I thought it was heroic, whatever they told me. And as people, no matter what they had, you know, women that had the guts to share, you know, I thought it was always harder for the women to talk to me about stuff going on with them because of the gender difference, or the few gay people I had in my ward that would talk to me. I always felt like it was heroic. And so I hope all of our leaders learn that we want to, you know, as people open up in the bishop's office, we want to make those experiences positive for them and just reinforce them as they guts to talk. I would often use the phrase, my respect for you just went up, even though if they confess sin, I would often say, my respect for you just went up a few notches for having the guts to tell me what you just told me.
I love that response.
And that was never in a training meeting. It's just something I felt Heavenly Father prompt me. And so I think we can do better as we as priesthood leaders are just trying to first get on someone's road and understand where they are before we become prescriptive. So maybe we could spend more time trying to learn where people are and the backstory of where they are and understand really how to minister to them before we become prescriptive and sort of say, well, this is what we need to do about whatever you're talking to me about. Let's talk about, and I realize we're skipping way ahead. We're just skipped over a decade, and maybe you'll want to come back to that decade.
That's okay.
And you've written a couple pieces that have been recent, but talk about the meeting on January 28th, the meeting that you and I both went to. Do you want to talk about that meeting and introduce Bishop and Sister Augustine and who they are and how you came aware of that meeting and then your experience at that meeting?
Yeah. So my friend Morgan, shout out to Morgan.
Is this Morgan that lives down in Vegas?
Yeah.
She's
Birdie.
Awesome.
Birdie? Is that exciting? I don't know how to say her last name. Sorry, Morgan.
We're going to have Morgan come on and tell her story.
Yeah.
And her mom and her wife.
Mom, Debbie Day, who I love. Yeah, so she only knew me from Facebook and from the things that I've written. I know, again, I'm probably sounding self-aggrandizing when I say that. I've been fortunate to have a more public platform because I've been a regular contributor for the Huffington Post for the last 2 years. And I've also had some op-eds published in the Trib and have written
That's
for Rational
awesome.
Face. And anyway,
thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome. So anyway, it's given me exposure to people that I wouldn't have otherwise had.
Because part of your calling, John, to tell your story.
Thank you. That's kind. So because of that, because of those platforms and because of, I've been lucky to have them promote my pieces, I've had more people be exposed to me who I haven't necessarily met in real life. And Morgan is one of those people, and she felt connected with some of the things that I've written and shared about my experience, especially as a gay Mormon, and so, and as is the case with her mom. So she reached out to me and was strongly encouraging of me to come to this meeting that was happening, and I was skeptical, not because I had ill feelings necessarily. That was the overarching thing. I mean, I was deeply hurt by the November 5th, 2015 policy change. The exclusion policy, and that categorized same-sex couples as apostates and forbade their children from being baptized or ordained while they were living with a same-sex parent, and that only then if they only could they join the church if they officially disavowed their parents' relationship after turning 18. That was deeply wounding to me in many ways, and which is interesting. It was that coincided with my writing. Like I had, that's part of the story. I had, after leaving BYU, like I said, in 2007, and transferring to the U, my undergrad is in creative writing. I always wanted to be a writer, but I'd felt like maybe I could do more good, more one-on-one good as a therapist, as a psychotherapist. And due to all the pain and trauma around that, like, and not knowing how to tell my story because that was tied up in so much shame, as I've said, I stopped writing really for a decade. And I stopped, not just publicly, I stopped journaling, I stopped writing, and I had been a really prolific reader and a prolific writer and avid reader before that. And I stopped doing it. And then I've been writing Facebook posts, some of them longer as the medium changed to allow us to write longer things. But the first public thing that I wrote was a letter to LDS church leadership that got published as an op-ed in the Trib, that describing my reaction to the November 2015 policy change, that got a lot of traction on social media and was given to Michael Otterson, who gave it to Elder Christofferson before he gave his interview. So that was something that I felt like, oh, like maybe through writing, like I can have a voice still and have a voice in Mormonism and a voice that maybe would impact people or help increase their compassion or their understanding for it. So I had continued to write about that experience. Morgan had connected to my experience through things that I'd written, and starting with that one. And she said, you need to come to this meeting. And I was confused and intrigued, but I can read my piece about it if you want, or I can, I don't know. I feel like you'd mentioned that in the email. So if you want me to do that, I can, but that would be long maybe for a podcast. It's already, I don't want to test people's patience, but I don't know if you want me to read it or if you'd rather have me tell about it.
Tell about it.
Okay.
Just by introducing it, the piece that John ended up writing, I think has gotten, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shares, hundreds and hundreds of likes. It led to the LDS Living article that was later published. But talk about your experience and going into that meeting.
Okay, yeah. So I was hesitant for the reasons that I said. And like I said, I hadn't been, besides going to some baptisms and baby blessings and mission farewells and homecomings that I'd been invited to over the last decade, I hadn't gone to just a traditional service in over 10 years. And so I didn't respond right away, but she told me that it was a meeting for and about the needs of LGBTQ Latter-day Saints. And I hadn't heard of anything like that happening. Like during the day, it wasn't a fireside. It was essentially a fifth Sunday meeting, a combined Relief Society priesthood meeting. And that the whole ward had been invited to. It was not a sacrament meeting. People have been confused about that because I introduced it by saying that I walked into the building and there was a sacrament meeting already in progress for the other ward, but it was actually in the partitioned off cultural hall. And it was really beautiful when I walked in. That was the most powerful part of it to me, was just walking in and seeing so many of my friends who, like me, had not been in a church house, in a LDS meeting house for many years, all sitting there together. 282 people. I literally counted.
Wow.
In that room. So it was very hot as well. And, that's a phrase I use in the piece, was opening the door to a rush of body warmed air and seeing these 282 souls gathered there, which was, really striking and beautiful. And the contents of the meeting were beautiful as well. I'd missed the first two speakers because I was late, which also speaks to part of my pattern and also part of my avoidance, probably, of my reluctant participation in this thing. But Kent Carollo spoke first, and Carollo, and I know him and love him. He's great. And I've read since what he wrote, and my friend Ben, who's a professor at BYU, both of whom are active in the church, I missed their addresses, but I got there when my friends George and Allison Dusen were speaking. They lost their son, Stockton, to suicide. And they spoke about the anguish that they've experienced and the need for greater love and acceptance to make a place for people like Stockton in the church who may, like me, have felt excluded. And my friend Jordan spoke, who's married to her wife Amy, and spoke really poignantly, honestly, in a very raw way about some of the rejection that she's experienced from her own family and her desire, her yearning, her need to reconnect with them, and not being certain if that will happen, but finding other places to experience support and love, including among the people gathered there, but that not compensating in any way for the loss of familial support related to their adherence to their understanding of Mormon orthodoxy and teachings around this issue that has led them to be distanced. I didn't address any of that in detail in my piece, partly because I didn't want to privilege one piece over the other. And I didn't want to say, like, I missed the first two.
That's probably a good way to handle that.
Or to say, like, yeah, like there, I had in mind a Mormon audience when I was writing the piece, and I wanted to just say, like, there were, I said in brief that these were the people who spoke. This was the perspective that they were coming from. But I thought I wanted to honor Jordan's words and George and Allison's words by letting them speak them themselves. And people are welcome to look up their beautiful addresses online, which I think are important and worthy of our consideration and deserve to be heard in the sanctity of that context of understanding where they're coming from, because people may just hear it as hurt or of taking offense to something of how they felt excluded. But I think there was anybody who was present in that meeting could hear the love that they have felt for this community and the pain of what it feels like to not feel welcomed in. And Morgan and her mom, Debbie, spoke at the end. And then Paul Augustine, who I didn't know at the time was the bishop, spoke at the end. And it was kind of a miracle. I just kept looking around the whole time thinking, like, is this really happening? And, like, seeing all the people who were gathered there and the way they were dressed and everybody with their piercings and their crazy ties or no ties. And, but yeah, seeing them, like I said in the piece, everybody graciously saying amen at the end of every speaker, and all the speakers, regardless of their own relationship to Mormonism, ending with the name of Jesus Christ, amen. And yeah, it was this beautiful merging of those disparate worlds that I talked about that felt like they were going to, the division of which was arbitrarily imposed between my identities as gay and Mormon, felt like it was going to rend me in two. It felt like some kind of joining of that in that moment, that there was a place for both, and there was real healing in that.
I love that.
Thank you. You were there. I was so happy to see you there. You got some shout outs in the meetings. People feel your love. And
it was a fascinating for me meeting John. Here we are both coming to the same meeting. I had come from my 3-hour block. And obviously I'm an active member and walked into that culture hall that was packed. I got there a little late too. And I reckon
lateness solidarity.
Yeah, there we are. And I was looking around at just people's faces. It seemed like most of the people in the front rows were members of the congregation that Bishop Augustine and his wife invited to stay. I think this was a meeting after the 3-hour block that they could stay to, and I think most of their ward did stay, and they sort of occupied those front seats. But I was watching a lot of the meeting thinking, these are wonderful members of our church that are hearing about LGBTQ for the first time. And I watched their faces, and I saw tears over and over again in the congregation in the front 4 or 5 rows where I was sitting. Now, I'm sure there were tears in the back where more of the LGBTQ people were sitting, but I just felt Christ's spirit there as we were coming together to learn who everybody is and better understand. We have to hear everybody's stories to be able to touch everybody's cross. And I just love the ability to do that. And so it was a very fascinating meeting for me, and I loved, and I thought it can be a template for how we can do this in the church. It's part of our, as you know, John, and our listeners, I think, know, part of our baptism covenants. I love the challenge that Mormon gave at the Waters of Mormon, or Alma gave at the Waters of Mormon, he, when he issued a baptism challenge, he didn't first go a list of commandments. He went horizontal about how we treat people. Hmm. You know, that was his baptism invitation, mourn and comfort and bear burdens. And I think to do that, we need to hear people's stories. And so I thought it was just such a basic 101 Mormonism thing. And it was a beautiful meeting for me just to hear these stories. It helped me to understand LGBTQ people better so I could understand the journey they're on and the cross they bear and how I can be helpful for them. Hmm. But I recognize that that meeting was also helpful for LGBTQ people that recognize the institutional church has generated a great deal of pain. I believe in the restored church. I'm a fully believing member, but I recognize our institutional church can generate great pain in our members. Hmm. And I recognize that that's happened in spades for LGBTQ members. But then I see LGBTQ people at church that are connected to Mormonism being healed a little bit in a meeting like that. And I don't know if you felt some of that healing being there.
I did. And it's interesting that I didn't write about this part in my piece. And they'd actually asked me, the LDS Living Editorial Board had asked me to add this, but I will add it now. I guess partly why I didn't is because I had wanted to speak to the hopeful pieces of that and to the redemptive pieces of that, and the piece is honest and real. I try to write, I hope, everything from that framework, which I know because I cry whenever I write things, and I know like that's connecting to some real emotion in me. I feel like writing is therapy and catharsis for all of us who feel compelled to do it, and so that. That said, I did have some mixed feelings even after walking in. Like the sight that I saw was beautiful to me. I was moved by the speakers, but that initial walking in, maybe partly because I was late, partly because it was so crowded, partly because of people then turning and looking at me, I did have a moment of wanting to turn back around and leave because I felt exposed. I felt vulnerable. I wondered what
That's
I was,
really
was
honest.
Doing there.
That's really honest.
And, yeah, I maybe should have included that, but like that wasn't, that's the antecedent to the preceding part, to what I wanted to share, which is that, I had never met him, but, like I said, Morgan invited me. And so her brother-in-law, she had I think shown him what I looked like, shown a Facebook, photo of me to him, but to keep an eye out for me. And so I walked in, I was having that moment of hesitation after that initial real beautiful moment of being overwhelmed by it, which is maybe part of why it all felt like too much and didn't know how to process all those feelings. I probably would have come back in, but had wanted to initially step out, like I said, but in that moment of hesitation, like he got up from his and motioned me over. This guy I'd never seen who happened to be quite handsome, and I was like, sure. but insisted that I come sit by them, and I'd never met him before. But so Debbie's daughter and Morgan's sister, this man is married to Morgan's sister. I think his name is Eric. He's saved a seat by him, right next to him for me, and ushered me over and said, are you John Bonner? My sister said
that's
to keep
cool.
My sister said to keep an eye out for you.
That's cool.
Yeah, and I sat down, and he put his arm around me, and said, "I was saving you this place," which I thought was really beautiful. I should have included that. Should have written that in the piece. I didn't know how to do it in like a way that didn't create some kind of specialness or privilege of like, and they were, and they'll save you a seat too. If you come back, like I felt like that was, that felt like, I don't ever use this term, a tender mercy. That was a beautiful part.
I love that. He just said, he put his arm around you, which means something. There's something so about the human race of putting your arm around somebody. And saying you're safe with me and you're welcome here and we've saved you a seat. Mm-hmm. That's just a great principle for all of us as we're thinking about people walking into our congregation and how we handle people and what Christ would do. There's such beauty in that simple act of what Courtney and her husband did. I think that might be Courtney.
I think so.
I know Morgan has a sister named Courtney, so if it's not Courtney, it's another sister and her husband.
Both, I met her sisters. They were both lovely to me. That's part of why I struggled to like know how to include that, because I didn't want it to be about the specialness of me having a designated spot. I think it's the app. Like I feel like maybe God knew how stubborn I can be and needed an extra nudge of having a particular space saved for me in order to sit my butt in that metal folding chair and stay. So I felt an additional level of welcome because there was a literal seat saved for me at that meeting. And I have thought many times since, like, what would that be like? Just if there weren't a general welcome, but if people were specifically waiting for you, saving you a place, how many people might feel compelled to return? So.
Wow. I love the beauty in that. I've always felt, and I'll talk about this in a lot of podcasts, that our congregations need to reflect what Jesus taught, and they need to be safe for everyone who considers Mormonism their spiritual home. And I've always felt there shouldn't be a belief hurdle or a behavior hurdle. We can save that for the temple. Everybody should be welcome, unless they're an activist yelling at the speaker. but so many in my singles ward, their home was Mormonism, but for a variety of reasons, they didn't feel welcome in the congregation. Mm. And I just look at Christ would want everybody to feel welcome. And I love hearing your story of someone whose spiritual connection is Mormonism, hasn't been going for 10 years, had the courage to walk into this meeting late. That takes courage. Thanks. To open the door and wonder how many people are going to turn around and look at you, John.
Everybody who's listening who knows me is going to be like, that's how John arrives everywhere.
That's how John arrives
I'm the latest
everywhere.
Person to everything. So,
and so
that's one of my weaknesses.
But then to have the beauty of this couple, and maybe even the straight guy. You know, maybe there's even some, it's one thing for the straight woman to put her arm around you, but there's something in my mind that likes the beauty of the straight guy.
Absolutely. That's why it was so pointed
to
me.
Knew you were the gay guy.
Right.
And said, I saved a seat for you. Sit by me, and put his arm around you in public. And I just thought that to me is what Christ would do. And that to me is the beauty of the rising generation and the beauty of so many people in our community, in our church that are meeting LGBTQ people, getting to know them and realizing that they're Heavenly Father's finest sons and daughters. And as I've talked before, it's not about me rescuing LGBTQ people anymore. That happens at times, but it's often about LGBTQ people helping me be a better person and a better disciple of Christ. And I can't become the person God wants me to be with just staying without the beauty of all of his children in my life. Hmm. And I think more and more of our members are understanding that.
I love you highlighting the poignancy of that. I think that there was, it was significant that he did that. And I think he could have thought I was a little crazy. He hadn't met me. I mean, he had no way of knowing all the deep well of feelings that I have been articulating in this podcast that were brought with me through those doors. When I came to that meeting, he might've seen that I was, a little anxious or a little overwhelmed, but he had no way of knowing what that meant for me. But when I sat down, I got emotional because of him putting his arm around me, and he could have thought, like, who's this guy, or moved away, or been annoyed by that. I mean, I think that that's not something that there's always good space for, right? I think that that part of his gender and his sexual orientation is significant in that story, because we're acculturated to do the opposite of that. He could have bristled, he could have stiffened and moved away, but he saw me getting emotional, and instead he pulled me in. He pulled me in closer, like his arm that was already around me, like after seeing me get emotional, and gave me a hug, and yeah, that did feel like exactly what you said. This is what Christ would do. That felt like a real example of that.
John, thanks for sharing that with us. That's pretty tender, and there's a measure of healing that I assume you felt in that moment that is much needed in your life. And I think that's a beautiful story for all our listeners to know that, to hear you share that in an honest, vulnerable way, and helps us all know how to touch each other's cross, and so we can do better. And that's really a purpose of this podcast. But thank you for sharing that. That whole experience was such a, that was so easy to do, but so impactful. And I'm just touched hearing that. And it makes me want to do better. It makes me want, as I sit in a congregation, to look for people or anywhere to see what I can do just to lift someone and help someone, because that seems to be our mission in life. Talk as we kind of close about one thing I remember is the last two out of the cultural hall were you and me. We both went up and wanted to talk to all those speakers. And by the time we talked to all those speakers, it was just you and me.
That's true.
And I remember giving you a big hug and was so grateful to see you there. And we both had just shared this wonderful, beautiful experience. And I think we both left there thinking this could be something that could be scaled. We've got to find a way. Neither of us are activists. Neither of us are campaigning on downtown Salt Lake how to do things. But I think this is something that you and me and many feel that needs to be something that we need to do more of. And I hope we can do more of that, because our congregations want to know how to do this. It helps our congregations and it helps us know how to minister to all of our LGBTQ members. So I hope and pray that more of these type of experience will happen. But you left, and then you wrote this wonderful Facebook post, I think the next day, January 29th, after you left the Augustine's ward in Riverton. And I read that post, and that post is the one we're talking about that went viral. And then LDS Living, I assume, talked to you and said, would you write, can we take this post and make it part of LDS Living? And as you'll probably talk about, LDS Living is a church-owned organization that's potentially writing a piece that you quote unquote, a gay and active man is written.
Yeah. I wanted to say that, you were part of me writing it too. Like that experience talking to you at the end with people leaving and then finally being the two of us and us, warmly embracing me and having my shoulders in your hands and so talking about what had happened there. Like it was important to me to capture that, to see like the light and enthusiasm in your eyes as you talked about this and wishing that that could happen everywhere. I wanted to give voice to that. So you were part of it being written. You were an instrumental part of it being written in the first place. The LDS Living did not approach me. I was really grateful that it got the traction that it did. It was my original version of it. I was lucky to have it have hundreds of shares and a couple thousand likes, and I shared it. It got shared in some different venues, and so people were responding to me with the same kind of enthusiasm that you did at the end of that meeting, as it was the two of us linger honors at the end of saying like, how can we get this to happen elsewhere? And I thought, I want to capture that because I've been given the blessing in life of being able to put some of what is in my heart into words, and to be fortunate to have people want to read it and to be lucky to have it be published. And I thought, who needs to read this? Who needs to hear this? And how could they hear it? And so I had the thought, and it seemed crazy to me, like, well, what if I could submit it to Des News or to LDS Living? Because I thought these are venues that could publish it that would give it a different kind of credibility for a Mormon audience. And I thought, I did some research and saw that they had never published anything like this before. They had published things about the topic, of course, and people who were still active in the church, people who had returned to the church who were LGBTQ, but nobody who had left the church with no set plans to return as the author themselves. And so I didn't know if that would happen. So I reached out to Tom Christofferson, who is a good friend of mine, and Julie D'Azevedo Hanks, both of whom I know and love, knowing that they have been published there and that they've had connections there. So I said, hey, what do you, they had both reacted already to the original piece that I wrote. And I said, what do you think? What do you think the LDS Living might think of this? And I reached out to my friend Allison, who's the editor of the U.S. edition of the Deseret News. And I said, what do you think? And they all said, we love it. We will give it to, we will put you in direct contact with, the editors. And so they did. And, this feels, inspired or fortuitous to me. The woman who is the the editor that I submitted it to, who worked with Tom after his great book came out about his own experience of merging his Mormon and gay identities. She was at the meeting, and so she read my piece with an added level of tenderness and poignancy for it because she was there, and that felt meant to be. So she went to bat for me. It wasn't an easier, smooth process because of what I said. Like, I didn't know that the church owned LDS Living at the time. I knew that they had been previously an independent, autonomous organization. And then they became a division of Deseret Book, which is owned by the church. And so that creates different layers of approval for what gets published or consideration for what gets published, because they're no longer independent. They are a subsidiary of Deseret Book and then therefore directly owned or employed by the church as a publication. And so because of that, it just took a couple weeks and a couple different rounds of what was going to be left in, what was going to be taken out. There were only two lines that they asked me to remove or revise, and they asked me to add an additional section of where we could go from here, what we could do to be more welcoming. And I got beautiful responses from their editorial board, which my editor there, Jamie, passed along to me, and I was really moved by them. And I was just kind of holding my breath. You had asked me to do this podcast from the original post, and I kind of put you off, but I didn't want to jinx it. I didn't tell anybody at all because I thought, is LDS Living really going to do that? They actually asked me to add additional 400 words to expand it to a 1600 word piece. And they had to wait to see if it would be approved by the quote unquote powers that be, because of the considerations that I already named. And got final word, and I cried a lot because it did feel healing in a particular way. It felt, I never know how to speak to these things without sending self-aggrandizing. But with all humility, I say that I'm grateful to have been able to have words as something that become stories that are able to touch people or affect them or speak to their own experience. That's the greatest gift that I've been given. It's the most important thing to me, to be able to tell stories in an honest way and hopefully sometimes in an artful way. And it felt healing because of all the reasons that I've said today, of the unceremoniously leaving the Tabernacle Choir and BYU and the church, being away from it for 10 years, having lots of negative reactions from people and lots of loving, supportive reactions, but an equal number of people who were disappointed, who responded out of genuine concern, but their fear led them to say things that were hurtful or harmful, trying to convince me to come back, trying to warn me of what was to come, losing my voice or credibility like I'd spoken to before, of feeling like I was somebody who had, because of having a tender and sometimes overly sensitive heart and growing up with an English professor, father, and loving words, being able to sometimes capture that in my own words, and having that be something that people identify as something powerful for them, feeling like I'd lost that and not having a voice anymore among people who had come to rely on that voice before in my days as a fully integrated Mormon. This felt like a coming full circle of that, of having some of those same people share this piece, message me about it, seeing it shared by wards, by stake websites, seeing it just a couple hours ago reach 10,000 shares on Facebook.
10,000 shares is a big deal.
Which again, so I'm going to be lots of caveats about tooting my own horn. It doesn't feel like that now. This, people are going to roll their eyes of being the instrument or whatever, but I did feel about this piece, which makes me sound the Mormonist and not hopefully agnostic, but just Mormon. I felt prompted or inspired to write it. I felt, I wrote it over the course of 6 hours, and I didn't get up. I didn't use the restroom. I didn't eat during that time. I wrote and revised and revised and thought, how can people hear what I'm trying to say? Which means that I have to dig into my own love of Mormonism, my own hurt at leaving, my own wish for people to feel welcomed and included there, including myself. And it felt purposeful. It felt intentional. It felt like there was a mindful aspect from a power beyond me of this happening and this being connected through a dear friend who I'm lucky to know through various other circumstances of becoming close to Tom and having him connect me to his editor after writing his own book, and her having been at this meeting and her editorial board being open at this particular time to wanting to run this piece, even though they've never before published something by an openly gay, formerly active Mormon person. And I'm proud of the 10,000 shares just because it means that people who never otherwise would have read what I had written or considered my experience as legitimate wanted to share it with the people closest to them. And that felt like a full circle thing in the context of, and I never know what to do with this, right? Like, we have our patriarchal blessings and becoming a hopeful agnostic. It's hard to know where to put that, but it's always been something that was really tender to me. And feeling like I'd lost that, the section of about the role or influence that I would have. A ministering role to a number of saints beyond my imagining, and I thought that would never happen. And this week it feels like it did, in a way that I never could have foreseen, which gives lots of legitimacy to a path that people for a long time insisted was a wayward one, which has felt like a purposeful one to me now and a redemptive one in a way that I can't fully articulate to you, but maybe you can hear in my voice. It fills me with lots of emotion to have a place and a voice there.
Thank you, John. I hope, as I'm sitting here doing this podcast with John, I've got tears in my eyes. John's got tears in his eyes and
running down his nose.
I'm struck with so many different emotions here. One of my thoughts is, you know, the healing that has occurred, obviously, in John's life is his beautiful voice that he's had, and that voice has been manifested in so many different ways through music and through writing and through healing people through his clinical work is now being used in a wonderful way within our church to help people understand LGBTQ people in a way that I think a lot of members of our church are wanting to understand. And John being a leader in that area as he's sharing his voice. Another thought that comes to my mind is that, you know, this is what I feel is perhaps your foreordained mission in life, John, is the very road you're on. And that this is not some random thing that you signed up for this earth life. You signed up for this very difficult road because you realize the beauty of this road and its ability to help other people and heal other people, that no other road you could have chosen could have done what you're doing now. And that there are more chapters to be written for what you're doing. And another pivot perhaps has occurred with your voice being kind of now a authorized voice, so to speak, because of the LDS Living article and people within the Orthodox Church recognizing that it's okay to listen to your voice and how helpful your voice can be for all of us. As I think most Mormons and most Christians on the earth want to do the best they can to honor their baptism covenants and to be good Christians. And as I have become an ally and have talked to so many people, I think that, especially with our millennials, they want to know how to be, this is part of the doctrine of our church, to love and support everybody. And it's part of our baptism covenants, and it's part of what Christ taught, and you're helping us learn how to do that because we're hearing your story. I'm reminded as you talk, John, of a pivot perhaps that occurred in our church. I think some are aware of this, but in November, at BYU, November of 2017, President M. Russell Ballard, acting president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, spoke at a BYU devotional, and he said, quote, "Every member has a place in God's kingdom. It may be difficult for gay Latter-day Saints to see where you fit in the Lord's church, but you do. and this maybe is my favorite, Mormon leaders, along with rank and file, need to listen to and understand what LGBTQ members are feeling and experiencing. We must do better than we have in the past until all feel they have a spiritual home, a place to worship and serve God, Lord. So to me, what Bishop and Sister Augustine and that ward did, and what you're doing now, sharing your story, is supported by President Ballard. And I think a pivot is occurred in the church where we're recognizing no one's sort of talking about changing doctrine in this podcast or advocating to the church what they need to do, but we're just clearly talking about within our doctrine that we can learn and listen and love each other, and we can touch everybody's cross. I've said that several times today. John, I'd like to share a tweet with you. When I tweeted out about your story, my tweet was titled, "Great story about my dear friend John Bonner. He is one of the finest men I know." And then I linked to the LDS Living article, and one of the people that I follow and followed me back on Twitter is Jeremy Guthrie. Jeremy Guthrie is a professional baseball player that recently retired. He pitched for the Kansas City Royals. He pitched in the World Series. He's Mormon, and he's just been called as a mission president for the church. He's assigned to Houston, and I kind of hope my son goes to his mission. But it's interesting what soon-to-be President Guthrie, former major league pitcher, tweeted back at me. He said, "This is really powerful and filled with the Spirit. Thank you, John, for sharing. And may you feel the living welcome of not only the Savior, but each of his family of striving disciples." And I thought, that's just another example of the hundreds and hundreds of members of our church that you are touching. From a future mission president, a former Major League Baseball player, to me and to hundreds and hundreds of others. And thank you for sharing your story with us, and thank you for the LDS Living article. Any concluding thoughts, John, as we wind up?
Yeah, I wanted to thank you. I think there aren't a whole lot of things that I believe as capital T truths. I hold them as sacred when I do, and a few of those are that I believe it's important for us to just love, as I said in the piece, and also that there's tremendous power in sharing our stories. And so you hosting this podcast and inviting me to come on as your first gay guest, first interviewee, is a great honor, because I do believe that. I mean, that's one of the ties in all the roles that are most important to me in my life. Like when I think of myself and maybe what I'm meant to do here, I think about being a therapist and being a singer and being a writer and being a friend and family member. And to me, the common thread in that tapestry is the power of stories, the power of storytelling, of listening to each other, of being present for each other, of doing that through music, through word, through podcasts, but just coming to know somebody's heart and its vulnerability and its strength. And when we sit across from somebody and we do that, or we read their words, or we hear them, really hear them, we can't help but be changed by it. Somebody that we may have thought we had nothing in common with, that we would never find common ground with, we may feel angry with or contemptuous toward, but that changes us when we can just be present to listen to them. So thank you for offering me that.
Thank you, John. Thank you for joining us for this podcast. And I love you, brother. You're one of the finest people I know. And
I feel love you just back.
Pure goodness around you. And may you be sustained in all the good you're doing with your clinical work, with your writing, and your unique life mission. And my feeling is you've blessed so many people, and you will continue to bless so many people. And I'm honored to be walking this road with you. Thanks to Tom, our producer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I feel the same about you.